Good Friday morning. This is Food Conversations. This is the last Food Conversation series till September. Some of us are taking the summer off. I'm Steve Corey, the host for today's show. My guest is none other than Warren Bell, a local physician and one of the founders of the Canadian Physicians for the Environment, CAPE. And among other activities, and there are many in this community, he is the chair of the board of directors of Voice of the Shuswap Broadcast Society. He has hosted Food Conversations since January of this year. For this show, however, his considerable knowledge and experience in the whole realm of food and nutrition and their relationship to good health is our focus. Whole food, preferably organic, local produce and products. Warren Bell, how does it feel to be the guest on Food Conversations?
Well, I'm doing my best to hold up. One thing I didn't have to do is prepare for the show. It was already in my head.
Yes, I'm sure it is. And I'm sure there's lots of stuff we're going to try and drag it out. We will. So you have been here in Salmon Arm since 1979. What brought you here?
What basically brought my wife and I back to BC, where we were both born and raised, was the aging of our parents and the obvious need at some point that they would have for support as they went through their aging process. We looked for work in various parts of the province and settled in Salmon Arm because it was exquisitely beautiful the time we arrived. It was April, and to look at the place, and everything was green, and in Montreal, where we'd been living for 7 years, everything was brown and desiccated and looked like it was essentially lifeless. I mean, it comes to life very brilliantly in a month or two, but BC was already there, and it was really beautiful.
Yeah, Salmon Arm has. And you've been here for about 40-some-odd years, so I guess you like it.
Yes. It's often we've said, well, we could live anywhere, but we're here now, and if something else comes along that's better, we'll go, but it never did.
I happen to be among those many thousands of people that are very happy that you stayed.
Thank you very much.
So where did you do your residency?
I did my residency at McGill. I did my medical sort of undergrad previous to the MD degree at UBC and at McGill, so I kind of split it off. I actually was accepted into two medical schools because I followed a book called How to Get Into Medical School. Ended up with accepting both. So we went to McGill, did the very first family medicine residency that McGill had ever staged.
Oh, and I know that it wasn't residency in BC, but were there big differences between British Columbia in medicine and McGill in Montreal?
The most important difference, of course, is that it's a francophone world. And I happened to be a francophile. I was interested in French culture and language in Vancouver, so I ended up, actually, for some of my medical student colleagues in Montreal, translating for patients, because at McGill, there were still a lot of people proud to never have learned French, and I had. So it was an interesting experience, a wonderful city and culture, and McGill has a long tradition, very similar in their medical programs, but with the depth of 100 extra years of history that McGill has over UBC.
Oh, okay. So I want to jump right into a review how you came to this emphasis on good food, because we've talked about that, and it's something. It's not that you're necessarily an anomaly, I would say an exception, though, in the medical field, in that a lot of doctors today, good doctors, don't seem to have the same emphasis on good food and whole food that you seem to have in my discussions with you, and you've obviously found its very therapeutic value. And because your medical training did not lead you there into this food, how and when did you begin this journey and why? So I'd like you to tell me about that. Why is it that food somehow became so important to you?
In around 1975, when I was doing my third year of medicine at McGill, I switched after second year from UBC to McGill, I started to realize how significantly enmeshed the profession was with the pharmaceutical industry. We started to receive freebies from the industry. I received a very expensive stethoscope engraved with the name of Eli Lilly. The drug company gave it to us. We all got one. I was offered birth control pills for my wife, which was completely bizarre. Then I realized that a volume of information that we were all given, a great big tome that was had a blue cover, it's called the Blue Book, or the CPS, Compendium of Pharmaceuticals and Specialties, arrived in my sort of inbox, and I was surprised. And then I started to read it, and I started to think, this is a bit commercial. And that led me to actually write a paper, which took 8 years to be published, critiquing this Compendium of Pharmaceutical Specialties, because it became clear that it was actually a promotional volume. And that led me to be quite skeptical about our interaction, the interaction between doctors and drug companies. And that meant I was spending a lot of time telling people, I don't think this drug is useful for you, but I wanted to do something positive. And I wanted to branch out and find things I could recommend for people, things that were concrete and things they could do. And I branched out into the whole field of nutrition, physical activity, different kinds of modalities of healing. But I bought a textbook called Davidson's Textbook in Nutrition, 7th edition. I bought it because it was written by an Englishman and you could actually read it as good prose, and underlined everything in the book and studied it.
Did you get that book in Montreal? Or here in Salmon Arm?
I bought it here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because we'd arrived back here, and I'd been here about a year and a half. The paper was published, and I would say, okay, I'm done that. Now I want to be more positive, and I wanted to have positive recommendation to make to people. So I bought Davidson, and then after that, for the next 15, 20 years, I went to workshops and seminars and conferences and courses on nutrition, on micronutrient therapy, on every modality you could possibly think of. And along the way, I was also doing in-depth psychotherapy. So I was actually asking people a lot of questions about their lives. And it became clear that for many people, they didn't have a lot of material resources and they couldn't always either afford or even find time to learn about nutrition. So I spent a lot of time educating patients and exploring their food habits.
So what about your colleagues? Were there other colleagues that were partially maybe on the same page, or was it a pretty lonely trip that you took?
Well, I should make one thing clear, and that is that the training in nutrition, in physical activity, in other kinds of modalities of therapy in medical school is absolutely abysmal. That word is abysmal. Not bad.
Non-existent. Almost non-existent.
It's very close to being non-existent. At McGill, in my entire medical training, I had 4 hours of nutritional training because there was a very pretty nutritionist at McGill who was on the good side of the head of the department, and she was allowed to have access to medical students. So seven of us sat there for 4 hours. At the time, believing this was completely irrelevant because everything we were taught was, the only thing you need to do is know the treatment for your disease and everything else will take care of itself. It's astonishing.
Yes. In other words, the medical profession really had no role to play in keeping people healthy. It had a role to play in fixing them when they got sick or hurt or whatever.
The course that everybody in medical school looked forward to was pathology, disease. When you talk about disease, then we as medical students got excited because that's what we were supposed to do, stamp out disease, which is a little peculiar, but it's part of the culture of medicine, if you like, and has been that way for many years.
Yeah, rather disconcerting, I would say. But is it changing? Is it still about like it was in the late 70s, or have we come somewhere?
It is changing. I mean, society is changing, and medicine is a reflection of society. So there is more interest in branching out, looking at other ways of engendering healing, looking at preventive practices. One of the problems that holds this back is that teaching in medicine is almost solely done by specialists. And specialists only know often about disease. I mean, they know something about prevention, but their whole focus is treating sometimes complex, sometimes common disease entities and not looking at the whole person. When you go to an ENT, an ear, nose, and throat doctor, he or she is only interested in your ear, your ears, because you have two, your nose, and your throat and associated structures. But you, the whole of you, is not on their table.
So this is why it appears the increase or the popularity of naturopaths who use the word holistic a little bit more.
Yeah, there is a current in medicine called integrative medicine.
Yes, yes.
And integrative medicine, it was at one time holistic, it was one time alternative. I think integrative is a notion that says all therapeutic modalities have some virtues. They're not all perfect, nor are they all flawed. They all have some role to play. And the things that we do in our lives play the primary role, the habits we have, the repetitive behaviors that we undertake, really have the dominant effect on our long-term health and well-being. So why not explore that and learn something about it? And that process is taking place slowly. It's an uphill battle because this long tradition of waiting for somebody to get sick and then intervening is pretty deeply embedded in the medical profession.
Yeah, I sense that. Let's go back to 1980 when you arrived, or 1979, you arrived in Salmon Arm. What did you do when you got here first? What was the first thing you did? I understand that's rather an interesting little anecdote.
Yes, it's actually written up in a book about family physicians who arrived in rural settings to practice and had interesting stories. I can't remember the name of the book, but I had to write it up for the book. I arrived on July 1st weekend. All of my colleagues had plans for the long weekend. And so they said, hi, nice to see you here. Here you are. You're covering for all of us. Goodbye. So I was left in charge of a 5-person clinic over the long weekend in my first weekend in Salmon Arm, which probably caused several of the hairs that are missing in my head to take a hike at that point. The experience was fascinating. I had worked in emergency rooms in Montreal for several years, so I was kind of up to date on what you do when somebody comes in dire straits or just anxious and you'd never met them before. And what I really wasn't very good at, because I didn't have very adequate training at McGill, was childbirth. And so I don't know if I had a delivery on that weekend, but around that time I did, and that started me on a real journey to learn more about a pregnancy and childbirth. And of course, when you do that, you learn about nutrition. But that immersion, I was right in, embedded in the healthcare system from the get-go when I arrived here, and it stayed that way for quite some time. It's now sort of moving back a little bit.
So you stayed at that clinic for about a year, I think you said?
I was there for a year. The guy who ran the clinic would invite people to join the clinic, and periodically, quite regularly actually, he'd say, well, no, it isn't working out. You can go. Or the person would decide not to go because they didn't feel they were, you know, that welcome. There was probably 7 or 8 who were sent away after I left. But I set up my own practice, which again was a bit unusual, but it worked well for me because as I knew I was starting to embrace, I really at that point started to think this is the time to branch out. And so I did. And it would have been more difficult in a clinic because, just for example, the clinic I started in, they had drawers and cupboards full of free drug samples, so-called. And it was very peculiar.
Yeah, it sounds like a very interesting time. Tell me a little bit about this, you called it when in our discussions, the therapeutics of healthy living. Let's go into that a little bit because it sort of divides it up into 3 areas. Tell me about that, please.
There is growing recognition that, as I said earlier, what we do in our daily lives plays the central role in our long-term health. It's nothing to do with people like me in my line of work as doctors, nurses, hospitals. We're there for accidents, for unexpected illnesses, for strange and inexplicable symptoms to try and figure them out. But by and large, most people live a long and healthy life if they develop habits that lead them to have a long and healthy life. And there's been research done around the world that has shown this is true. And if you want to stay out of the, as people sometimes say to me, you know, I hate going to doctors, and I say, well, here's some things you could do. And then I watch to see if they're actually doing them. The sort of basic principles fall into 3 broad categories. One is what we put into our bodies. The second is what we do with our bodies, how we move around or don't. And the third is the social interconnections we have with other people.
Yes. Okay. So those 1, 2, 3, I love them. I mean, for me anyway, I love, you know, being able to categorize things 1, 2, 3. I'd like to talk about each one of them. Of course, food and what you consume. Let's go into that one first, because I think it's, I don't know, it's one
this
of the most...
This is called Food Conversations.
It is. It is. And it's probably one of the most important, not the, but anyway, let's talk about food first and tell me some of the things that you discovered, let's say, about food, because we're now in 2021. In those days, in the 1980s and 90s, what was going on? What were the things that were becoming in vogue or very popular?
It's pretty clear that through the first 30 years after the Second World War, the food system, the system that produces food, changed fairly radically. Most food up to that time had been grown on farms that were embedded or around larger population centers. When I was a child in the lower mainland of British Columbia, we would buy food from farmers in Lulu Island. We'd buy strawberries every year, the corn and the strawberries. I remember them because we'd have a lot of them, and it was very nice. But as time went by, and especially in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a transition driven probably by good intentions, the intentions being that everybody should have access to inexpensive food. It led, along with some other patterns like global communication systems and travel system, it led to a transformation of the food sector into food grown where labor was cheap and transshipped to places where people ate.
So let's talk about Earl Butz. His role in this, about what year? Do you remember what year?
About 1982. His enunciation was, in short, everybody in the United States should have access. He was an American, Secretary of the Interior, I believe.
Right.
And he said everybody should have access to abundant, inexpensive food. In other words, sort of like the ordinary person should not go hungry. That was sort of his goal. It meshed very much with the developing industrial food production system, where companies like Cargill and Archer Midland Daniels could take on the role of fulfilling this promise. And food was now a product, not a form of sustenance. So you might not eat any food from your neighborhood, but you could eat food in your neighborhood store, but it came from a long distance away. And today, of course, we know this, it's become almost normative. We think that that's the way food happens.
So the intention was good. Everybody gets lots of food, access to cheap. They didn't have the word really good food in there, but that, so it started changing the whole way we do things. I recall myself when I was young, the same type of thing. People went to the store a lot more often and got fresher food more often. Sort of like anybody who's been to France, they do it. They still do. The Europeans, I think, in general, and that's where they get their fresh food every day or two or three times a week.
The market in Paris is huge. The fresh food market in Paris is absolutely ginormous. And it's the food is brought in every day and the market gets set up and there are stalls everywhere. And every little town in France has done this. And it's interesting because the French government for years has been criticized for subsidizing its small farmers. And yet they are now still the backbone, and more countries are recognizing that that's a good way to do it. Protect your farmers so they can grow food for you, not necessarily grow food to be shipped to another country.
Well, that was that era. What would be that era of exploding globalization? Mm-hmm. 1980s, starting in that era?
It started after the Second World War, and it slowly built up. And then by the 1980s and 90s, it was in full force. And now we're still seeing it as the dominant system. But there's also a recognition that that produces lower quality food. It engenders a lot of social inequity. It means people who work hard all day long in some parts of the world are often not able to get all the food they need because the food they grow is shipped across the globe to other countries.
Stories abound. I don't know if you remember in 2001 when the WTO TO, the World Trade Organization, had a meeting
in Seattle.
I think 2001. I'm not sure, but I remember one in Mexico in. Not Cozumel, what am I thinking of the name? At any rate, I always remember a fence, a security fence, and there was, I hate to say this on the air, but there was a sign, WTO kills farmers, and a Korean farmer had put it up and had committed suicide. Hmm. And so, of course, you never got the explanation, but what the explanation was is that countries such as the United States, Europe, were producing rice, the main staple in Korea, and they were shipping it at a lower price to Korea than he could produce it. So by the millions or thousands, they were going out of business.
The American government had a policy of supporting businesses that wanted to, they use the word, penetrate foreign markets. And they would get a subsidy while they were moving into those foreign markets, which would theoretically give them a financial advantage over the local food production systems. It wasn't just for food, it was for other industries as well. And it meant that American entrepreneurs could go to a foreign country, sell goods into that market at a lower price because they were subsidized. And as soon as they'd established what they would call a beachhead, very much militarized terminology, they would then the subsidy would be withdrawn when they were making lots of money. So they destroyed half of the local industry or the local food production system. And that kind of behavior is not, that's a form of neocolonialism and exploitation.
And I hope it's changing.
It is changing.
Yeah.
Because more people are aware that this is inappropriate.
Yeah. Anyway, we were getting, I just want to bring us, pull us back to, we were talking about the first one was the in the therapeutics of healthy living. Healthful living. Food was the first one. What's the second one?
Well, the second really is how physically active and in what way we are physically active throughout our lifespan. The idea that physical activity is unnecessary or an adjunct or irrelevant is really very much out of touch with the history of the human race. 400,000 years, we were foragers, very much like our indigenous friends and neighbors here.
Who
in this
are
part
still
of the world.
Here to teach us some of the things that they used to survive and that we might find not only interesting, we might find them critical. Eh?
Well, not only that, but it's, and I'm sure right, you know, these days we're thinking a lot about the relationships between our indigenous neighbors and the non-indigenous settlers who've come to this part of the world. And there are so many things that they could teach us. Their community bonds were far more firmly established than ours. We've lost much of that, not all of it, but we lost much of it. All their food was local and fresh and wild. So it was untrammeled, if you like, by human interference. And their degree of physical activity was astonishing. And it shows what people are capable of if we don't sit around, you know, on the sofa watching soap opera with a bag of chips.
We've sort of been sucked in, I guess. I don't know how to put it.
Well, there is also a counterbalancing tendency in humans. There's been research showing this. If there's an easier way physically to do something, easier and faster, everybody, doesn't matter who you are, indigenous, non-indigenous, just anybody, if there's a faster, less energy consumptive way of doing something, we will go for it. And even though we don't have to go for it, it's sort of built into our genetic heritage, you might say. And we have to sort of unlearn some of that and say, well, we don't have to be active, but we're going to choose to be active. And you see people doing that nowadays.
Well, of course, yeah.
The word exercise up until the beginning of the 20th century meant military maneuvers. It did not mean physical
exercise, movement. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. That's a whole other area of discussion. We're talking about food. But food, I think, is intricately connected with this number three, how you interact with others, your social. Tell me about that, please.
Well, a good example of that would be the difference between fast food and slow food. And fast food is the term that grew up when various food distribution systems and food outlets came across this notion that people could be fed instantly. They could drive their car right up to a window and say, give me this, and hand over some money, and boom, they're gone in 30 seconds. In fact, as you probably know, some of these vendors had a commitment. If we don't feed you within a minute, you get something for free. Yeah. So this whole idea of speeding up the acquisition of food and the preparation of food became really quite dominant in many parts of the industrial world. And that led, when this approach came to Italy, where food and food, social food habits are very important for many, many people in Italian culture, there was a pushback, and it was called, and it is called formally with capital letters, the slow food movement.
Started in Italy.
Did in Italy. And it it is an approach that says how you prepare the food, who you do it with, how much you enjoy each other's company, how much time you take to savor the food and appreciate it, and engage with your friends and family who are there in a bit of a festive kind of interaction.
Somebody would say, that's all secondary. It's all kind of nice. It's really nice. But how does that relate to good health?
Please. Well, there's two ways it relates. One is that if you take time to prepare the food, you do a better job. You don't just sort of shove it in a machine and it goes bang, bang, bang. It comes out in little cubes at the end. That's part of it. But the other thing is that when you actually eat food in a congenial atmosphere, your metabolism is directly affected by that. Your digestive system, you know, the so-called fight or flight system, is shut down, and your digestive system gets far more blood supply, the production of digestive enzymes and various other components of digestion is markedly increased. It's been shown that if you're in an agitated state and you try to eat, your stomach won't digest it. It just sits in your stomach like a rock.
That's rather interesting. I want to draw some studies that were done, or refer to them, that you mentioned. There's some important things they found over a long period of time. Please tell me about the Grant study.
Well, the Grant study was a long-term study. In, I think, 1933, a freshman class at Harvard, back then, by the way, it was all males, which is pretty silly, but that's what happened back then, was told that they were going to be studied until they were dead. Now, of course, they were young, healthy males, and they had a long life ahead of them, and as it turns out, the study was in its 75th year, not so long ago. And the finding from this study was that if you summarized the whole point of what makes you live a long and healthy life, and especially a life that you enjoy, the study administrator said it's one word, love. And it's interesting because you don't hear scientists using words like love in public. They may talk to their family about it, but they don't actually realize or accept that it's a concept that is profoundly important in human relationships. And essentially they found that people who were in what could be called a circle of affection did better than people who are not. Now, a circle of affection means a kind of social grouping. It might be your family, but it might not be your family. It might be your neighborhood. It might be your village, if you lived in a village, because they studied community.
Often we use a general term called your tribe.
Yeah, your tribe is a very good way to put it, because it's a description of a historical entity that's been with us for literally hundreds of thousands of years. At any rate, they found that if you had this community around you where you could be of value to them and they could be of value to you, it was a reciprocal kind of a relationship. It wasn't like I'm selflessly helping you and you don't give me anything in return. It's a mutual kind of relationship. In that setting, people's lives, the quality of their lives was enhanced, and ultimately, their longevity was enhanced as well, and their ability to stay healthy.
Was food part of the Grant study?
Not part of the Grant study. I have a handout in my office that I have given to a number of people over the years. It's called Nine Lessons. I think the full title is
Lessons for Living Longer and Healthier Lives.
That's right. And that's based on another body of research that I combined with the Grant study to kind of give a long-term perspective and a broad perspective for patients that came to my office on what it is that you need to do or that you can do if you choose to be healthy. And the other study was a set of studies called the Blue Zones Project. It's now under the direction of the National Geographic Society in the United States. But originally was research done through academic settings. And the point of the research was to go around the world and look at communities where people are known to be living longer, healthier lives and find out what they were doing relative to the surrounding communities. And commonalities emerged, and the commonalities are, I put it in 9 lessons because the Blue Zones people use that formulation. By the way, Blue Zones came from the fact that the original research was done by researchers who owned a blue felt pen, and every time they found a community, they'd outline it on the map with this blue felt pen. So it's a very, it's not a very scientific thing, but it's very eloquent.
Well, it's a way of referring to it. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to those 9 lessons if we get time near the end of the show and just quickly go through them and remind you, the listener, that if you ever want a copy of that, you can either get it through Warren Bell, his office, Dr. Warren Bell, or we'll make it available here at the station. I think it's kind of a neat little handout to have, you know, to remind you. But getting back to the grant study, and there's a number of things that come out of that, but let's go into food directly. And you once told me, actually during our discussions, you told me that the use of supplements and micronutrients and the things that we, they are an indication of deficiencies. They're a sign of a failed food system. Mm-hmm. Would you explain that?
It's been demonstrated over and over again that people who eat a whole foods diet, assuming that there's a certain abundance of food, it's not like you're having to starve for long periods of time, although it's, as it turns out, we're actually okay if we starve for periods of time. And that's what fasting is all about. It's formally making yourself starve, but our bodies are adapted to lack of food for periods of time. It actually does us good.
Yes.
It doesn't mean you should...
I think the ancients knew that, and even some of the people that wrote the Bible.
Well, it's interesting. The fasting for most of the history of humankind has been involuntary. In other words, in February and March, when the winter in temperate climates, when the winter was abating, finding food was often difficult, and it was pretty skimpy. And when food came back in, you would eat food. You wouldn't necessarily go on a fast in the middle of summer. If you had access to lots of food, you'd eat as much as you could. The Nootka people on the west coast of Vancouver Island during the salmon run would harvest the salmon, fork them into their canoes, go to the shore, and eat sushi all day. They'd eat raw salmon and fall asleep on the bank of the river. And then when they woke up, they just go on eating again. And they do that for several days and gain maybe 4, 5, 10 pounds, whatever, in weight. And an observer, an American sailor who was living with them because he'd been captured by them for 2 years, initially being typically prejudiced about indigenous habits, thought that this was sort of crude. And then he realized that they did that in the fall because it would make them much more likely to survive through a hard winter if they had a hard winter. So we've not always fasted voluntarily, but we have almost always in, the 400,000 years of human culture fasted involuntarily, and our bodies are designed for it. It does us, we adapt to it very
well. That's one aspect of the failed food system, in that it certainly isn't in the vernacular or, let's say, everyday advertising on television. You should be doing some. In fact, it's the complete opposite. So when you talk about a failed food system, would you talk about that, please?
Well, it's there are other aspects of it as well. One of which is that we have developed an industrial approach to food production and to food consumption, as far as that goes. And with food production, it's meant that we have taken animal species and plant species, decided which ones we liked best, and then fostered their growth in huge amounts while neglecting the growth of other foods completely. So an orchard of almond trees stretching for miles down the edge of the highway is not unheard of in our world, But in ancient worlds, people knew that almonds were good to eat and other nuts are very nutritious, but they wouldn't plant them in separate plantations. They would have food forests where they would grow a few nut trees among the other trees that surrounded them in companionship.
Sort of trying to mimic Mother Nature.
They were trying to mimic Mother Nature and take Mother Nature's forces and adapt them, but not completely replace them with a whole different way of doing things. And as a result, with this sort of approach to what is generally called monoculture farming, where you take a plant or an animal and you just raise that plant or an animal in huge quantities and with very unusual so-called scientific data to justify that.
And they call it using the economy of scale.
Yes, the economy of scale, which has nothing to do with food, of course.
It has
to do with profit.
Yep.
And the net result of that is that we have developed a food system that leaves gaping holes in terms of micronutrient content. Micronutrients are small-scale ingredients that have a big role to play in a particular food. Many of them are things like antioxidants. Everybody knows about vitamins. People know about minerals. These are all components of food that are always there.
Yes, and I want to just try to get to this because it came up in our discussion, and that is people, if they eat whole food, preferably organic, preferably mostly plants, don't have to worry about getting all those micronutrients and supplements and I need this and I need that, because they'll all be present, or the ones they need should be present in the whole food.
A typical plant that has fairly active, say, aroma, and which is the aroma is often protective compounds are in the plant. Typically will have 200 or 300 compounds, separate compounds in it, chemical compounds, as well as structural compounds. And those, all those ingredients in the plant work together to facilitate its growth and its survival. They also tend to be things that are good for the consumer of the plant. For example, if you don't use pesticides insecticides on a plant, the plant has to develop its own compounds to try and repel insect invaders. And in those compounds, there are many nutritional values that are useful for us if we eat the plant.
And the scientists don't often look at them.
Well, we have only started to really seriously look at them. There are people that have... Our system of agriculture has gone so far over in the direction of this economies of scale approach, this monoculture approach, this global distribution approach, that we've done ourselves a disservice. And now we're starting to recognize that that is a disservice, and we have to change the system back to something that resembles what's always been.
Which is what this food conversations are all about, and mm-hmm. It seems to be happening in the Shuswap. I really am optimistic when I see the Shuswap Food Action Society and the people that are working in it and this show and what it does, and it all comes together to, and it seems as though there a global movement, I think, towards community and more local growing of food.
Well, you know, Carl Jung talked about, the famous psychoanalyst and psychotherapist, talked about the collective unconscious, and he was it's a very interesting concept, and I'm just borrowing the term, but there is a kind of collective consciousness among people, within the human race. And when we attune ourselves to other species on this planet, our unconscious or our awareness of what's going on in the world expands, and we start to see more than just our own, as they call it, echo chamber as the human project. And that's what our ancestors did all the time. We've swung away from it into this tiny bubble where everything we humans do is important and everything all the other creatures do is unimportant. Now, it's a complete fabrication. It's a fantasy. It has nothing to do with reality. But when humans get an idea, we often run with it for a long time before we realize we're heading for a cliff. And the signs are there, you know, cliff ahead, you know, turn around or go off to the side. But it takes us a while to understand.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. I don't want to go into it too much, but you and I talked about the outcomes of the American system mm-hmm. of health mm-hmm. Aren't very good if you look at it.
That's the healthcare system. The nutritional outcomes.
Well, it's related.
Are related, and the physical activity outcomes. For a long time, if you go back to the post-war era, the American diet, which was steaks and roasts and eggs and dairy, you know, fresh milk was supposed to be nature's most nearly perfect food. That's cow's milk, which is a slogan. And I recall as a child being patted on the shoulder by my mother and given a kiss because I drank an entire quart, that's when we had quarts, of milk in one shot. And she said, well done, my boy, well done. And I think that attitude that somehow these foods are ideal has proven to be completely false. They're actually, in the large quantities we consume them, they are definitely harmful in terms of their long-term effects on human health.
Let's just for a moment talk about that, the food industry, just before I want to get into the last part in the last quarter, the contaminants in our food supply. But before we go there, I want you to talk to me about how the food industry exploits our basic desires, you know, that are in our DNA, like sweetness, salt, and fat. Please explain that.
We have a predilection when we eat food for foods that taste sweet, foods that have fat in them because you can taste fat. It has a consistency and a quality in our bodies that we sense very rapidly. And salt. Without salt, we are in big trouble. We need adequate salt in our diet. There's a bit of an anti-salt movement within the healthcare world, but that's probably talking about grossly excessive consumption of salt. But eating salt on a regular basis in a human diet is an essential ingredient. A couple of grams of salt a day are necessary for us to be healthy. So salt we like, sweetness we like, and fat we love.
And they use it all in the O. Henry bar, I understand.
I believe so.
Yeah. We're going to leave that now and go into the whole area of contaminants in our food supply. And I personally believe, and I think, Warren, you would agree that this is vital. This is very important. So let's go back to 1948. I think you talked about DDT coming into the market as a result being used in the Second World War, I believe.
Yeah, DDT had come in during the war earlier, and it was lauded because it was able to rid certain tropical areas of mosquito populations, which carried yellow fever in particular, but malaria as well. And it was one of the hallmark compounds that we now broadly call pesticides. They include herbicides, which kill off plants that we think we don't want, insecticides that kill off insects of all kinds, rodenticides that kill off small rodents like mice and rats, and fungicides that kill off funguses and molds. But there's many others as well. And they have become pervasive in the food system, but also pervasive in the lives of humanity and in the plants and animals around us and in our bodies when we don't necessarily want them to be there. Studies are now turning up all over the place. It's been very slow to look at these compounds in our food and in our bodies, but the studies are starting to accumulate, showing that many of these compounds are very durable. There's DDT metabolites in practically everybody in the world. Certainly in North America, if you do a test for DDE, which is the primary metabolite of DDT, you'll find it everywhere. In people and in many animals as
well. And it was banned in the 1960s, wasn't it?
As 70s, but it was definitely not supposed to be used. There is some evidence that maybe there's some clandestine use, and in some third world countries, because it's very cheap, it's still being used. So it's an example of the kinds of things that we've been doing kind of brainlessly. It worked really well, and so we expanded the use grossly, and now these compounds are everywhere. What is happening is, again, a pushback, like the slow food pushback against fast food. There's a pushback against chemical-based agriculture. But in the meantime, much of the food that we eat, unless it specifically is labeled and certified as organic, has quite considerable pesticide residues the most dramatic shift in this, it's been gradually increasing, the use of pesticides of one sort or another has been increasing for the last 70 years, starting in, as you mentioned, the late 40s with the introduction of a couple of herbicides that we now use all the time, and I'm blocking on some names, but
diazinon was one. I don't know when that one came.
That was actually insecticide. We should probably not speculate because we'll get some interesting but not necessarily accurate answers.
Okay, sorry.
But in the last 15 to 20 years, the use of Roundup and the active ingredient in Roundup, which is glyphosate, has absolutely taken off exponentially. Now you can't find a corner of the planet that does not have glyphosate in it. High mountain lakes have glyphosate. And the amount that's used is astonishing. It is now the leading herbicide and actually in many parts of the world, the leading pesticide of all pesticides. It's the one most used. And that's only in the last 15 to 20 years. It's just taken off. And plants, as you probably know, the listeners probably know, have been created
genetically
in the laboratory,
modified, yeah,
that are resistant to glyphosate, which is an extremely potent herbicide. It kills just about everything. In fact, when Monsanto first started to experiment with it, they were horrified and a bit dismayed because it was so powerful that there wasn't a plant in the world that could survive. It blocks an enzyme called EPSPS in plants, but it's not found in animals. It's found in some funguses and some bacteria. But the bottom line is that this compound was thought to be completely innocuous for all animal life, including humans. And it's so innocuous, considered to be so innocuous, that the Food and Agriculture Association, that's not the right name, of the American body that controls food and agriculture.
Oh, the FDA?
No, that's the Food and Drug Administration. Anyway, that doesn't matter.
Okay.
They declared it not meriting research.
Oh yeah,
because for health, because it is considered absolutely innocuous, and they base that on what Monsanto told them.
Yeah.
There's been this very tight relationship between the chemical and the pesticide industry and many other industries as well, but specifically those industries and the governments.
But we're getting a lot of pushback now.
We're getting pushback because, there's a lot of revelations about the way the world really is going on right now. The most distressing are those finding graves of indigenous children at residential schools, laying bare the horror of residential schools. But more and more research is showing, and lawsuits are showing, how harmful some of these compounds are. There are two or three lawsuits have been awarded exclusively to the plaintiff, saying that the exposure to glyphosate caused their illnesses, specifically non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and other cancers. And the evidence is appearing that Monsanto knew that it disturbed genetic material in living life forms all along, but they just suppressed the evidence.
Sort of like cigarettes, isn't it?
Yeah. The model for the industrial approach to societal product distribution, if you want to call it that, has been based on the tobacco industry. Ever since the tobacco industry had these enormous successes for decades, keeping regulators at bay and making the scientific community spin out of control and fail to understand how harmful their products were, ever since the tobacco industry showed how it can be done, multiple global industries have taken on the techniques and the methodologies of the tobacco industry, and we have to roll that back. It's causing tremendous harm to humanity and the planet.
There are those who would argue that the whole system has to crumble because it's so. I don't want to say that it's corrupt, but I do recall reading about, especially when there was some people very concerned about GMOs, genetically modified organisms, yeah, and finding its way into our food. And, of course, some people were just plain suspicious.
The issue here is the motivation of the people doing it.
Yeah.
Because, for example, when somebody says, we got to get rid of government, well, you can try doing that and wandering down the street and say, who's going to fix the road? What about the lamps, the street lamps that are burnt out? You know, we're going to just put the bulbs up, climb up the pole ourselves?
Hospitals.
Exactly, hospital. We need certain structures in our society. So rather than just getting rid of what's there, we have to replace it with something that's better.
Yes.
And the better, in the case of food, is local food, because it's fresher, it has more nutrients still present in it, and there's lots of research starting to emerge showing that. It has to be organically grown, meaning we have to roll back this chemically dependent industry producing food. It has to be produced fairly. It's absolutely unacceptable for workers in faraway places from where we live here in the shoe swap to be producing food for our benefit, but being paid either a pittance or treated absolutely despicably by the people who are running the food plantations, which is what they are.
Yeah, and the food industry. Mm. Yeah, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I doubt if we have the time, but there's two things I'd like to do. One is I'd like to ask you, Warren Bell, my guest today. He's a general practitioner here in Salmon Arm. Let's quickly go through a couple of minutes the 9 lessons for living longer and healthier lives. And if you don't have your copy in front of you, I have one.
The lessons are, as I said earlier, based on 2 bodies of research, the Grant study from Harvard and the Blue Zones work that's been done around the world and is now coordinated by the National Geographic Society of the United States. So the first lesson is pretty obvious, but it deserves to be said, and that is, don't be inactive. You don't have to run a marathon, but you have to keep active if you want your body to work properly. And that means you lift a few things, and you climb up a few hills, and you move around, and you exert yourself, and you do it on a regular basis. You don't just do it for 2 months of the year when the weather's nice. You do it all year round.
Okay, number two.
Number two is that the first part of it says don't go on a diet, meaning a formalized, restricted food intake system. It means also that you eat widely, broadly, you eat smaller servings. One thing that many people around the world who live longer lives say all very consistently is, I don't eat until I'm full. I eat until I'm not hungry. In other words, when you're satiated, you don't feel hungry anymore, that's when they stop eating, not when they're busting and they can barely move away from the table. Then number three says, eat more plant foods. It's good for the planet. It's good for our bodies. There's a myth going around that we used to call foraging communities hunter-gatherers. We put the hunter first, and that's because it was men, mostly. But as it turns out, it was the women and old folks and children who harvested food that were supplying about 70% of the calories and the nutrient density. Now, there are some things you get from meat that are unique. Today, we can get them from other sources. But the idea that you wouldn't, our ancestors were out just eating woolly mammoths or whatever, is actually inaccurate.
I like number four.
Number four says, you can have, many, many communities have an alcoholic beverage, not a lot of alcoholic beverage, just one, with the company of their friends and neighbors and family.
I like red wine.
Thank you. To all listeners, in case you have any doubts.
Yeah, if I come over for dinner, red wine.
Red wine. Then the next lessons, numbers 5 through 9, are all about meaning in life. So the lesson number 5 talks about developing a sense of purpose in the form of writing out a mission statement for what you think your life should be.
Okay.
Now, we do that for organizations, but
we only got 2 minutes left.
Okay. Slow down. Slow down. You got that? Slow down and pause and take time to appreciate the things that are going on in your life, and especially things that you like doing and people you like being with.
Yes.
Number 7 talks about, in loose terms, the spiritual dimension of people's lives.
Yes.
It doesn't matter whether you join a group or you have a systematic approach to things you don't understand that are large, but if you look at the universe, you'll see it's a big place. Number 8, make something out of the relationships with people that are important to you. It doesn't have to be your family. It might be your family. Ideally, it would be your family, but it doesn't have to be. And finally, it talks about this notion that I mentioned in the base of the Grant study. Have a group of people around you who you find you're compatible with and they find you're compatible with them. having that kind of community is a powerful thing to do.
In another program, Warren Bell, I'd like to go into another handout you brought in today, the new therapeutic commandments, thou shalt. And we don't have time today. I want to thank you, Warren Bell, for coming in. And I know that in the fall, we will be doing more interviews on this whole subject of food conversations. Thank you again for coming in.
Thank you very much, Steve.